welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside Simon and I today is Deputy Knowledge and Product Editor Sarah Davidson. And a happy new year, one and all. But will it be a happy new year for the pounds in our pockets? We'll pore over what stories the team think will be grabbing their attention in 2018, what worrying trends or scandals they'll be keeping an eye out for as well. Also, will savers finally manage to find decent returns once again? What will be the major themes impacting investments? Will house prices grind to a halt or regional cities set for a boom? And also today, we're going to be discussing tax returns. But you really need to get your skates on, especially if you've never done it before. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, making saving that little bit more exciting.
But first, a happy new year, Simon and Sarah. Any new year's resolutions for you, Sarah?
Oh, the usual. Drink less, smoke less, sort my finances out.
Excellent stuff. Simon, for you?
No, I'm not really one to make New Year's resolutions, to be perfectly honest.
That's the spirit, everybody. So we ended 2017, didn't we, talking about the rises of cryptocurrencies, interest rates and stock markets, Brexit, never far from our minds, and of course there's plenty more besides. But what will be the big themes of 2018? What do you think will be the topics that will be taking up your column inches? Any scandals, any worrying trends that we saw in 2017 that could push through? So I'm going to start with you. What do you reckon? What will be keeping your attention?
I think that a lot of the same things that have kept our attention this year, I would expect interest-only mortgages to continue to be an issue. A lot of those loans were given out 25 years ago without the necessity for borrowers to have a repayment vehicle. Those people are now reaching maturity and are finding that they have no way to repay their mortgage.
So, what could that practically mean?
Practically, so if you find yourself in that situation, what you should do is talk to your lender because they may be able to extend the term and you might be able to sort of switch to part and part repayment interest only to try and bring the debt down. Some people will find that they need to sell up, move to a smaller house in order to repay the mortgage. Ideally, I mean, if they've been in that home on that loan for that length of time, capital value should have risen sufficiently that they've got enough equity in their property to downsize. Some people will be switching to equity release. Last year we saw a few new entrants into the retirement mortgage space, so that kind of later life lending, which had been really tricky after 2014 when new rules came into the mortgage market. I think we'll see more developing in that, you know, lending into retirement and past
retirement. So that could be something that we're going to see more of this year?
I think so.
What else do you think perhaps will continue?
I think that the pensions market, we've seen a lot of discussion around transferring out of DB pensions into DC plans to allow access to the pension freedoms. I think that there's been questions around whether or not that's a sensible thing to do, to give up a guaranteed income in your retirement for the rest of your life, just in order to access your savings in a lump sum. The question remains whether or not it's advisable, and I think the regulator is looking into that, so we may see some answers around that as well this year.
Simon, happy new year. Do you reckon Brexit is going to play on our mind a little bit more this year?
Oh, Brexit. I'd nearly forgotten about that one.
Sorry, Simon.
Joy of joys. I suppose we probably will spend some time talking about that, won't we, this year?
I imagine so. Stars we mean to go on, eh?
Indeed. And I should at this point apologise to all of our listeners for my rather husky voice, because like most people, I have started the new year ill. Brexit, I think, look, we had a little bit of optimism, didn't we, at the end of last year? We got to the point where we could actually start negotiating a deal, apparently, because we'd got the divorce bit done. What I would expect to see is a lot of misinformation, people saying one thing and doing the other, a lot of the EU looking like it's trying to pull a fast one constantly as part of the negotiation process. And what I wouldn't expect is a great deal of clarity. We're meant to be leaving in March 2019. It'd be nice to think that by the end of December 2018, we'd know how we were going to be leaving. I would be very surprised if that is actually the case. I suspect that we're not going to know how we're going to be leaving the EU until about a month before we're meant to be doing it. Who knows? But what I do know is that in a negotiation process like that, the whole thing of negotiating is you have to play your cards close to your chest. You can't just stand there and openly say, well, this is what we want, unless the other side is willing to negotiate for a mutually beneficial outcome. And I think what we've seen, unfortunately, in the Brexit negotiations so far is that we don't appear to be involved in a negotiation for a mutually beneficial outcome. It'd be nice if everybody just changed their minds and tried to do what was best for Britain and best for Europe. But I won't spend the entire year waiting for that one.
I understand the idea of keeping cards close to your chest, but I imagine as a business you'll be looking beyond 2018 into 2019, 2020 to trying to figure out what your strategy is going to be, and that must be incredibly difficult. But in terms of the material impact that it's going to have closer to home on us, we haven't really seen it, have we, through 2017? We got towards the end of the year, people a little bit more pessimistic, perhaps the high streets, particularly us not going out and spending so much, as to what you can say that's related to Brexit. Also food price inflation going up. Are we going to see house prices have held pretty steady, I would suggest, in the face of that? Are we going to see it practically have more of an impact on us, the way we think, the way we spend?
If I'm going to be entirely honest...
By the way, don't worry about your voice. Some people might like the husky as well. The coughing and the sniffing,
sorry,
we could do... Yeah, but, apologies, you know, the husky, we like. Go for it.
If I'm going to be entirely honest, I don't really look at a scenario where Britons are doing less shopping and finding house prices are going up slower to be a particularly bad one. Mm. I think we spend more than enough money on shopping, probably more than we can afford, if you look at our national credit card bill, and that house prices are already considerably well above as high as they need to be, certainly when you compare them to wages. So the thing that I would be looking for this year, and I would be hoping for, is that we all get a little bit richer. And where that comes in is if we can see some sustained wage inflation at the same time as inflation starts to fall away. So we've seen inflation pick up, peaked at 3.1% so far, still running at that, off the back of the fall in the pound after Brexit. And that took a long while to filter through because shops tried to protect people for as long as possible from the price rises. Now, if the Bank of England is to be believed, that should now fall away. Hopefully, we can become a bit more productive. We can pay people the money that they need to earn. If we can see 2 to 3% wage increases and inflation fall below that, then over the next year, we might all get a bit richer. And then hopefully, you know, maybe at best, we can hope that perhaps property prices just stay steady, they don't keep going up, that rents stay steady. Train fares are unfortunately going up, as we know. Mm. But, you know, if we could just see some kind of steadiness in all those things, then we might feel a little bit richer, and then we might go into the whole leaving the EU thing with a bit more of a spring in our step.
A lot of maybes in that, Sarah. Are you optimistic, pessimistic about the year ahead in terms of the economy and our finances?
I'm sort of sitting on the fence, I would say. I think that wage inflation is the really big question. We have seen completely stagnant wage inflation over the past 10 years since the crisis. And the impetus for companies to pay their employees more, arguably, is not there because of this uncertainty created by Brexit. I also think because inflation is where it is, and we've had interest rates so low for so long, the bank is factoring in potentially two further quarter point rises, which would take base rate up to 1% by the end of the year. That will hit people in the pocket, certainly homeowners. It might be good news for savers on the flip side, but I also get the impression from mortgage lenders that appetite to lend is low. So I would expect lending this year to be a bit less than it was last year, maybe not much. That will have an impact on how affordable housing is.
We'll get on to, we'll discuss more about house prices, we'll get on to savers, but just want to know, borrowers particularly, Simon, we've got some pretty stark debt figures, haven't we, through last year, how much we were all putting onto credit cards. How much of a worry is our level of debt in this country, unsecured borrowing?
Well, it is a concern, and it's been a concern for some time. And what has been a concern is that it's persistent. And it fell away, the growth in it fell away, and it started to contract after the financial crisis, and then it picked up again. But to be honest, there is a phenomenon where you would expect that in an economy that was doing okay or doing well, and the British economy is doing somewhere between okay and well at the moment, that consumer borrowing would rise. That's just what happens. It's observable from the economic cycle. But I think there's a couple of things that concern me about it. One, it had been going up pretty swiftly. That has now actually tailed off. Lenders have very much got the message from the Bank of England. I think borrowers have got the message to a certain extent. Also, it's all very well saying, well, you would expect consumer debt to be rising when the economy is recovering. But what you would also expect to be happening when the economy is recovering is people's wages to be rising in real terms, so to be rising above inflation, and they haven't gone anywhere in real terms since 2007. So that's, again, where the problem comes in, is that our debt is getting bigger and our ability to pay it off is not getting greater. So that's what you need. Is like, it's fine if the debt goes up, if your ability to pay it up goes up as well. But if you've got a scenario where your ability to pay it off doesn't go up and the debt just keeps getting bigger, then you do have an issue.
I think there's also a question of the type of debt. There's like good debt and bad debt. So good debt typically is secured against an asset, a house usually, and bad debt is that unsecured borrowing on credit cards and personal loans. Credit card interest rates are sky high still. I mean, we're talking like between 18 and 25% in some cases.
10-year highs at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And I think that the worry is that people are leaning on that unsecured borrowing at very, very high rates of interest, because actually debt is going down in terms of that good debt is going down. So, and that's largely to do with stricter rules that have been brought in for mortgage borrowing, basically. So the worry is the balance between good debt and bad debt.
All right, then let's talk about one group who have had a bit of cause for pessimism as well over recent years, and that's been savers. Now, interest rates have been pitiful, squeezing those who rely on their funds to generate an income. But at the tail end of 2017, we did get a chink of light, albeit a small one. So have rates finally reached the bottom? Here's savings guru James Blower.
Well, I think there were some green shoots last year. Probably doesn't maybe feel like that to people, because, you know, we've probably hit the bottom of the savings market and bounced back from that. So if you look at an idea of rates last year, we started 2017 with 1.4 as the best buy on a 1 year and finished with it at 1.9. And at times it touched 2%. Similarly on internet access, we started with the best rates around 1 just over and finished at 1.3 and saw a top rate of 1.45 during the year. So there was actually, percentage-wise, quite a big improvement. I guess from a savers perspective, they'll still say, yeah, a lot of people will think, you know, 1.3 still isn't that great on instant access. We're a long way from the heady days of 6, 7% fixed rate bonds. So there was a significant improvement. I guess the big question is, will that be continued this year? I personally think it will. We are seeing an increasing number of new banks entering the market, and I think we're probably only halfway through that cycle. We've had 30 new banks come in. We've had another 8 or 9 other banks that either have existing license or an international banks or have got deposit taking added to their license. So we've had a flood of new entrants, and I see that continuing. There's about 30 banks still working through the process with the regulator to get a new license. Not all of those will make it, but I think we'll see quite a few more joining the fray. The competition's already intensified this year. Amongst the challenges, many of them are competing on price. We've also seen a few signs of some of the bigger banks coming in to play. The Lloyds Group for their BM Savings division were in the easy access market in December. We've seen some of the bigger building societies come back into the market. So I think there's lots of reasons for savers to be optimistic, but I don't think we're going to see savings rates flying anywhere near the highs that we've seen previously. But I think they should improve from where they are at the moment.
So have we reached rock bottom, Sarah?
If the experts are to be believed, then yes. We have seen rates go up reasonably over the past 6 months, probably. In some cases by 0.5%, which is amazing, especially because the interest, the base rate only went up by 0.25%. However, they are still pitiful. There isn't a single rate out there that beats inflation at 3.1%. So you're still actually losing money in real terms by leaving your savings in cash in any of the savings accounts that are available. If we see another base rate rise this year, then they are likely to go up. Competition is improving. There are a lot more challenger banks out there. Their objective is not really to make money on savings accounts, but to get deposits in. So they're offering some quite good rates. that's only going to increase, I think, over the course of this year.
What about open banking?
Open banking is coming in on the 13th of January.
There's a suggestion that could help.
Yeah, in terms of improving competition and visibility. So the premise behind open banking is that you can pull all of your current account information and savings accounts information into one place and view everything together, which should highlight, in theory, where you could save money and make more money. So if you currently have your savings in an account that you opened up 5 years ago and you're being paid 0.01% interest on it, the idea behind open banking is it'll pop up and say, did you know you could move your savings to this 2.5% two-year fixed rate bond, for example?
So forcing us almost to be more engaged with
our finances. Yeah, exactly. Just making it easier to do that switching process and see when you could and should switch. Mm. In practice, nothing is going to change overnight. This is going to be a long, slow burn. We've already seen several of the banks given an extension. Santander has a private bank called Cater Allen that's been given an extra year to implement open banking. So the ability of these new fintech apps that help you manage your money to actually sort of deliver on the promises that open banking makes is questionable in the short term, certainly.
Simon, your views, certainly you've been looking, I know, at pensioner bonds. Goodness me, I remember talking about those letters coming through their doors saying the time is up. So the question is, well, where do people go then?
Well, as a famous man once said, life moves pretty fast if you don't stop once in a while.
There you go.
Yeah, pensioner bonds, hey? That went quickly, didn't it?
Goodness.
3 years.
The podcast passed, do listen.
I know. If you fancy digging through the archives, you will find the excitement of 3 years ago when pensioner bonds were launched by NS&I at the behest of a certain Chancellor, Mr. G. Osborne, who had decided that it was time to offer the over 65s a stonkingly good deal, a choice of a 1 or a 3 year savings bond. 3 year bonds are maturing now, and those 3 year bonds paid 4% interest. That is an interest rate that has not been bettered at any point over those 3 years. So people are now getting letters from NS&I telling them that their bond is maturing and they have a choice. What do I do with my money? Now, they're not going to get 4%. Cold, hard reality, slap in the face. You're not going to find 4%, okay, on a savings account. The default option that NS&I will roll you over to is their new 3 year guaranteed growth bond that pays 2.2%. That's almost table topping. The top 3 year deal at the moment pays 2.21%. So people need to be thinking about what do they do with that cash. The maximum you could stick in was £10,000 into these things. So it'd be £10,000 for an individual. If you're a couple and you've got £20,000 in, it'd be £20,000. So you need to look at the best rival savings accounts out there. As I said, top rate is 2.21%. You're probably going to think for the sake of 0.01%, it's not worth moving your money from NS&I, which obviously is 100% government backed. But you might also think, well, perhaps I should take a 1 year fix or a 2 year fix. Maybe if I think interest rates are going to keep going up and I'm willing to accept a lower rate of interest now so that I can switch at a point that's sooner in the future to a higher rate of interest. Well, you might think that actually things are going to go really bad and interest rates aren't going to go anywhere. And you're going to take a 5 year deal instead. But the best rate you're going to get there is 2.5%. And realistically, the difference between 2.5% and 2.2% is not a huge amount. So I would say when people get these letters, get yourself onto This Is Money. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/save, which is our independent Best Buy savings tables. You can look through all the different fixed rate accounts. Easy access accounts, best one of those is 1.3% from RCI. iCash ISAs as well, if you want to try and get that money tax-free. But then also maybe some people could perhaps think about investing some of this money. I mean, that's not a call to arms to plunge headlong into the stock market when it's trading at an all-time high. But what it is to say that people need to think about what is this money for. Do they need this money? Do they need to spend this money for their day-to-day living expenses or for an emergency or something like that? Well, if they've locked it away in a product fix for 3 years, then probably they don't, actually. This is probably just money that they have. And if it's just money that they have and they've got no imminent need to spend it, they just want to be earning a return on it, then they can afford to think a bit long-term about it. And if they're the kind of person who's locked this money away for 3 years, they haven't needed it for 3 years, and they're thinking that the default option is to lock it away for another three, and they're not going to need it for another 3 years, then they could afford to think about investing it. And my choice, which is not to say it's the right choice for everyone, but if it was me, I'd be thinking about a good income investment trust, which pools your money with other investors, and you've got a fund manager out there picking the best shares. They're targeting those that invest for income. They're targeting companies that can pay stable dividends that have them well covered. And investment trusts have this thing where they can hold some money over in the good years to help pay the dividends in the bad, so that basically they hopefully won't have to cut that dividend. And you can find some investment trusts that have very, very long histories of raising their dividend year in, year out, or certainly protecting their dividend. And you can find yourself an investment trust that pays a dividend of 3.9%, stick that in an investing ISA, and that will be tax-free. You then potentially get to benefit from some capital growth. Yes, you might open your investing account one day and find out that your investment is down, but if you don't need to cash your investment in at that point, that is not a problem, and you can sit it out and hope till it goes up. And, you know, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it often rhymes, and you will find that the best return on your money comes from investing in the stock market. And I would look for a solid, steady eddy income investment trust if I was thinking about investing this money. But we're going to be doing a lot more on this in the weeks to come as to what people should do or what they can think about doing with their pensioner bond cash.
Investing may be an option then. As I said earlier, last year was stellar for stock market performance and the meteoric rise in the value of Bitcoin. But will the same companies and currencies perform well this year? Well, Sarah, you spoke to investment expert Juliet Schooling-Latter from Fund Caliber. Now, she looked at five themes that are likely to continue to influence the world of investing in 28 and five funds that could be worth a punt. So give us an idea, what was she telling you?
So the biggest story of December certainly was Bitcoin. It was everywhere. We saw the performance value go up in an almost vertical line, peaking in mid-December at about $19,000 per Bitcoin, which is just extraordinary. I mean, it's inflation of over 1,000%. It's since fallen back, unsurprisingly. Everyone was saying, it's a Bitcoin bubble, and it looks like the bubble is temporarily deflated. Mm. Whether or not it's burst remains to be seen. But what Juliet was saying was that if you don't want to invest in Bitcoin or can't afford to invest in Bitcoin directly, actually there are funds out there which have exposure to the same sort of technology that underlies Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is mined using blockchain, and there are several banks that are investing heavily in developing blockchain. Mm. So she was suggesting funds that look at those slightly unloved sectors of banks investing. So it's a kind of secondary exposure.
So the rise and possible fall of cryptocurrencies was the first one. Yeah. Potential US corporate tax cuts was another.
Yeah, and we've seen that go sort of halfway through. That's basically corporate tax and some personal taxes being cut enormously in the States, which Trump is saying will boost economic growth, will encourage investment.
It'd be an interesting one to watch from globally speaking as to this kind of experiment, as to how that will play out.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the markets are completely divided on it. Some people are saying it won't make a difference, and some people are saying it's going to be a complete game changer. I just think we have to see what happens.
Okay, so the rise of e-commerce was the next.
Yeah, e-commerce. So companies like Amazon, they have been investing in their own growth heavily. So Juliet was saying that she thinks there's probably significantly more growth to come over the next year.
Even in the face of loads of regulation, loads of press.
Yeah, and we saw e-commerce platforms targeted in the budget, actually, in November. So currently, if you are a seller selling via a platform like Amazon from outside the EU into the EU, you did not have to pay VAT, whereas after the budget, Amazon or the platform, whichever it is, eBay, for example, would be another one, will become liable for that VAT bill if their sellers are not paying it. So that's definitely going to have an impact, a big impact, I would think. But e-commerce, you know, if you look at the retail figures, that's, you know, people are shopping online more. So I think that's definitely a growth area.
What about two other things? So central bank tapering and growth prospects in emerging markets. Emerging markets, something we have heard quite a lot over the recent times.
I mean, I think emerging markets is an interesting one. They all kind of get lumped together, but they're very, very different prospects depending on which countries and continents you're looking at. Again, Juliet was saying that actually India has got some really good growth prospects. There are still big questions over China in terms of state intervention in big publicly listed companies. And indeed, going back to e-commerce, Tencent and Alibaba are two of China's biggest and most successful companies, but both suffer from regulation which protects the Chinese state rather than independent shareholders abroad. So things to think about.
Lots on there. Go to thisismoney.co.uk for the full article. But Simon, I want to ask you, what do you think will be the biggest impact next year on the world of investing? It doesn't have to be any of the ones that Juliet suggested. What do you think that you will be keeping an eye on?
People need to keep an eye on the US. I imagine they get sick of doing that. Although I must admit that this Donald Trump book is hilarious. These revelations coming out of this, true or not, they are hilarious and slightly disturbing. But the US makes up the bulk of the global stock market, more than 50%. And where the US leads, the rest of the world follows. And the US market is very expensive at the moment. Now, it may be expensive for a reason, because the US is doing well. It may be expensive because the US is going to continue doing well, and that these tax cuts are going to come in, going to deliver a lot of money to companies, and that companies are going to chuck that money back out to investors. Or you never know, they might even reinvest it into their businesses and become more productive, pay people higher wages and things like that. It's more likely they'll probably just hand it out as special dividends. But if the US falters, and you have to bear in mind that the moment it is priced for almost near perfection, then that will affect elsewhere. So my preference is to go looking for investments that look cheap, offer value, and I don't think the US does at the moment.
So keep an eye on the US, Simon. But you also gave us some hints of what you also think that people should be thinking about this year when it comes to investing. And you mentioned about dividends a little bit earlier, but who are the FTSE 100 stocks tipped to be next year's dividend heroes? Throw a few my way, because you've got an article on it on your website.
Okay, well, we've had a look at some of the companies that are tipped to pay out the highest dividends next year. These are not necessarily the ones that you want to definitely be invested in, because a company that is just paying out a high dividend may be a company that is richly rewarding its shareholders, or it may be a company that is struggling. And what that high dividend is showing is that they're paying out more than they can afford to, and it's going to be cut in the future. However, there is a strategy that actually involves buying the 10 highest dividend yielding companies in the FTSE 100 each year, holding them for a year and then cutting them. It's called the Dogs of the FTSE. It's done by our Midas Share Tips column. And actually, that's done pretty well. But the highest yielding shares on offer at the moment for this year, Centrica, that's looking at an 8% dividend yield. That is huge. BP, 6.1% dividend yield. Direct Line, 7.7% dividend yield. And these are all big companies. Royal Dutch Shell, 6% dividend yield. Vodafone, 6% dividend yield. Those are big, big numbers. The question that you have to ask yourself is, do you think that those dividends are going to be cut? All of those companies are very big, but all of them have got their own problems. And it might be that those problems start to weigh on them so much that they say, OK, sorry, shareholders, we can't pay you as much each year, so we're going to have to cut the dividend. So that's the risk you take.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
So what about house prices in 2018? Housing was yet again a hot topic last year and looks set to be so for some time. We had first-time buyer stamp duty acts in the budget, landlords again seemingly targeted by the government, and the number of homes being built is never far from the political and news agenda. So what will be the major themes with housing, do you think? Do you think we'll see a lot more of the same? Again, landlords targeted, the number of homes being built an issue. Sarah?
I mean, these are long, long-term problems. They're not going anywhere. The government has been very proactive in what it said it's going to do. It's committed quite a lot of money to supporting infrastructure that will help builders to deliver more homes. It's got ambitious targets. Construction is going up in the residential sector. So that's good news. Houses take a long time to build, though, and a long time to deliver. So I don't know whether or not that's going to have an immediate impact on property values, certainly not this year, I wouldn't think. I think landlords are probably hoping against all hope that they are left alone. They've had an awful lot to deal with over the past 18 months, nearly 2 years now. And a lot of those changes that were announced a couple of years ago, certainly the withdrawal of tax relief on their mortgage interest, that's being phased out over the next 2-3 years. And that's going to really start to hit them in the pockets this year. At the end of this month is the last tax return they will file where they've benefited from that high rate tax relief. So from next year, it's going to really start hurting.
I don't know how much correlation there's been between landlords being hit hard and rents going up. We have seen rents go up a huge amount last
year. I mean, well, they have gone up. It's really regional. So, yeah, so the average is kind of meaningless. It depends on where you are. So in London, rents are actually not rising. They're coming down, in fact. So it's becoming more affordable to be a renter.
But I think the average is £1,500, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why rents are coming down, because it's just at the limit.
It's never
of what
been affordable. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People cannot physically pay any more money. I mean, I'm a renter and I pay out like 75% of my salary on my rent, which is just extraordinary. But other pockets of the country, so in terms of all of these changes hitting landlords, what it's meant is that a lot of them have redefined their investment strategy. So that might mean selling up in areas where their yield is really low, and therefore their profits will be wiped out by this change. So they may be selling up in London and the southeast and moving that money to reinvest further north in cities like Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, Nottingham. These are places where yields are much more attractive. They're still, in some cases, you can get over 10% if you're investing in a certain type of property. The rents in those areas are probably set to rise. But in London, I would think they're going to come down.
So sorry if you're looking to rent in those places in the coming year and beyond. But that's rents. Simon, house prices, you spoke to some experts about their predictions. What are they telling you?
Well, the suggestion has been that prices might flatline. A recent poll conducted by Reuters, involving 28 housing market specialists, said that property prices would rise by 1.3% nationally. We had Nationwide come out and forecast a 1% rise. The Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors believes house price growth is likely to come to a halt in 2018 across the UK in general. HomeTrack says regional cities will boom while London realigns. Sarah Beeney has gone for prices will rise 2-3%. Savills has also gone for house prices to rise next year, except for London. It says that house prices will fall 2% in London next year, but all other areas will see a slight increase. And Henry Pryor, who is always a man worth listening to,
yep,
on all things property, because his job is to buy properties for people, which means that he does an awful lot more actual activity in the property market than most people does, has given us one of his typical lines where he says, house price forecasts only exist to make astrology look credible. But for what it's worth, I think that London house prices will sink lower in 2018, falling on average by another 5%, while nationally prices will be pretty flat. I expect UK house prices to end up 2% lower in 12 months' time. The quicksand in 2018 will be towards the end of the year, I fear. Who is going to want to commit to their biggest single purchase in the 6 months leading up to our departure from the EU in March 2019? Many buyers will wait until the dust settles. And I think that's very true. I think it could go one of either two ways. I think the market could suffer this year. You generally find with these things, things don't tend to just stay steady. They either go up or they go down. But it might go down by a small amount. Or you might actually find that this stamp duty cut for first-time buyers does actually give it a kind of a final leg up. And you might get this pause for breath, certainly, that's been going on in London for a while. This puts a little bit more money in buyers' pockets. You get a final leg up, and then all of a sudden you get the fall. And that's what happened last time round. If you look back to 2006, London property market in 2006, it had a similar scenario where it went from doing very, very, very well to not doing very well at all. People suddenly struggling to sell, and then it suddenly flipped back to raging ahead, and it did another year of raging ahead, and then you got the financial crisis and boom, it fell off a cliff. So you might find that we see the final leg up this year, or you might see that we see the final leg up next year. But I suspect at some point in the next 2 or 3 years, we are going to see a substantial fall in house prices, because they are very, very high, even in some areas where they've hardly risen at all since the financial crisis. I have a friend who owns a place in Newcastle and has not gone up in value at all since, you know, 2006, 2007. But as we were saying earlier in the show, people's wages haven't gone up at all since then. And those properties were expensive in 2007. So we're still in a scenario where property is expensive.
It's really hard, isn't it, Sarah? I mean, you talk about when is the right time to buy, are prices going to fall because of Brexit, et cetera, et cetera. But the difference between this and perhaps other investments is this is a place to live.
I think that's the absolutely critical thing to remember. If you're buying a property to let it out, that is an investment and the numbers matter. If you're buying a house to live in, it's your home. You may or may not benefit from any capital uplift in value over the time that you live there, but that's not really the point. You're buying it so you've got a roof over your head. trying to time the housing market. It's not worth it because you don't move house because you're trying to make yourself richer. You move house because you've had children and you need another bedroom or whatever. So you're kind of beholden to your lifestyle, really, in terms of when you move.
Also imagine the longer you wait as well, if interest rates are going to continue to rise, mortgages are going to become more expensive. So actually that could be taking...
Exactly. My own feeling is that we will see prices cool down this year. I think inflation, they'll stop rising. They may not actually fall in value, but I think towards the second half of this year, we'll really start to see that come through in the numbers. There's a lag. So you can sort of predict what's going to happen in the housing market in terms of value and transactions based on what's going on in the mortgage market, which happens 3 months ahead of the house price stuff coming out. And there is certainly less demand for purchase finance from mortgage lenders. There's less appetite to lend. That is going to feed through into the numbers, and it will have an impact on house prices, because people, if they can't borrow as much, will not be able to spend as much, so they will start to ask sellers to drop their prices. I think the other thing to say is the stamp duty cut, while brilliant for first-time buyers, doesn't help anyone else in the chain. These are still people who are trying to sell their homes. They're still going to have to pay the stamp duty, and they're going to be put under a lot of pressure to drop prices. We're already seeing that, you know, asking prices. So people putting offers in like 10-15% underneath the asking price.
All right then, from homes to what's on our driveways, I'm talking car sales. New car sales fell for the first time in 6 years last year, with diesel sales falling 17.1%. High taxes and pollution fears hitting demand there. Just a quick word on this, Simon. Do you expect that will continue?
Yes. As someone famously said this week, not this week, sorry, this last year. So not this week and not even this year, but last year.
We'll get there.
One of the bosses of one of the car dealerships said that we might have seen peak car. Basically, what he was referring to was a phenomenon that involved Britain buying an almost unbelievable amount of new cars, largely fueled by cheap PCP finance. So whether Britain was actually buying these cars or not is a matter of debate, or renting them. But you put your deposit down. The dealer tells you how much it will cost you per month to own said car for 36 months. You pay them the money for 36 months and then you hand the car back, and then you get another car and then you go around in circles. This has been absolutely booming, driving car sales to record levels. However, it came to a halt last year. And why did it come to a halt? Well, I mean, it might be that people just kind of got fed up with buying cars, or every single person who wanted a new car had already bought a new car. It also might be to do with the fact that some noises were made around this finance and whether there was a bubble and all these things like that, and people started to pay attention on the sort of dealership side in terms of like that. Bear in mind that these cars are being sold to people by car salesmen who are selling the finance alongside it. And some of the paperwork and some of the, let's just brush that little bit under the carpet for the affordability test here, stuff that's been going on was perhaps a little bit murky. But maybe we've seen a fall away in that. Maybe we've seen a fall away in people going, oh, maybe I shouldn't be borrowing this money. Maybe I should be a bit more cautious with my finances. And also the fact that new cars are pretty good, and you might find after 3 years you don't need a new one. But also because of this thing where the car dealers, when they structured the finance, always used to leave a little bit on the table for the car owner at the end of the deal. So then when they get to the end of the deal, you've got this guaranteed future value. And if the value of the car was, at the end of the deal, was lower than the guaranteed future value, you'd still get that guaranteed future value. You wouldn't have to pay them more money. If the value of it was higher, you'd get a bit of money back. And what they used to do is leave a bit of money on the table so people get a bit of money back, because that gave them a deposit to then put down on another car, start the cycle again. Famously, we also had a huge amount of PPI, reclaim money going on car deposits. Mm-hmm. And it might be that because they'd been just having to narrow these deals down as much as possible to keep getting people in the top of the funnel, that there's no more money left on the table for them. And there's also this issue where people are buying less diesel cars because they've been scared off by the rhetoric surrounding them. Why would you buy a newer diesel car if you think it's going to fall in value or it's going to get hammered by tax? And also because of the forecast of the future value of those diesel cars being lower, and the fact that PCP means you are effectively financing the depreciation, that makes getting that diesel car on the PCP more expensive. So either the car maker takes a hit on the car in 3 years' time, or it does an honest calculation and says that diesel car that we did say was going to be worth 50% less in 3 years' time, we now actually think it's going to be worth 60% less. And that means you've now got to finance 60% of the depreciation. So it's got more expensive for people to buy them. All of those things pushed together, though, has meant that car sales have dropped, but they have dropped from an astonishingly high level. But I think they will continue to fall throughout the year.
All right, finally, I feel it's our duty, our public service duty. It's that time of year. You've just weeks left to file your self-assessment tax return for the 2016-17 year. Do stay tuned, please. It's only a couple of minutes. But the only option left is to fill it in online. And while technically, yes, you do have until midnight, January the 31st, you may want to get your skates on now. So listen up. Why so quick, Sarah?
So open banking is coming in on the 13th of January. That is part of a wider European directive called the Payment Services Directive number 2, catchy title. And within that, there is a rule saying that third parties can no longer charge customers for using their credit cards to pay for things. So HMRC has made the decision that you will no longer be able to pay your tax bill using a credit card. And that deadline is the 13th.
So it seems a little bit mean, doesn't it?
I mean, I think it's going to hit a lot of people quite hard.
Because a lot of people pay thousands of pounds on their credit card. Things like the DVLA, they've said, oh, we'll just waiver it at the moment. I understand. So why couldn't HMRC have done the same thing? They've known about this for yonkies years.
Indeed, they have. Well, that's the decision that they've made. So I'm afraid we're all stuck with it. So if you want to pay on your credit card, you do still have time, but only a few, like a week, I think, from now. If you are happy to pay cash or bank transfer, then you have until the 31st of January.
I think they did say it was a bit unfair to push the cost onto general taxpayers who assume would have to foot the bill, but that's not the only reason you need to be quick, because it takes about 20 working days, doesn't it? Especially if you've never set this up before, is that right?
You need the access codes. This is the thing that makes most people fall down who leave it to the absolute last minute and don't do any looking into it whatsoever. You need the access codes to get into the government system so that you can file your tax return online, and they take time to get.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to apply for a gateway access ID, and then HMRC will send that to you on a piece of paper in the snail mail, and it can take up to 21 days to arrive. And then once you've got that, you then go in and register, and then you have to do your ID authentication. All of that takes time. And if you've never looked at a self-assessment tax return form either, I mean, they can be mind-boggling. So a lot of people pay accountants to help them.
So if needs be and you don't mind spending about 50,000 hours on the phone, you can call HMRC's helpline on 0300 200 3310. Public service announcement over. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news throughout 2018. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. Thank you very much to Simon. Thank you very much to Sarah. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.